This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a good period for conspiracy buffs, what with the film JFK, not to mention some of the more far-fetched explanations of the Iran-Contra scandal, the October surprise, and the AIDS epidemic. My guest, Chip Raleigh, tracks conspiracy theories and their origins, and he warns against the dangers of mixing fact and fantasy. Brulé also monitors fascist and racist groups in America. Some of those groups, he says, are where many paranoid conspiracy theories originate. Brulé is an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, a nonprofit research organization based in Boston, which monitors the activities of extremist groups and political movements. Brulé last joined us to discuss the New Alliance Party. I asked Chip Brulé what he regards as a conspiracy theory.
Conspiracy theories often contain elements of fact that are provable and documentable in the long run. And the real dilemma is sorting out those conspiracies that do in fact exist, criminal conspiracies, and those theories which are in fact unsubstantiated and undocumented and reflect a kind of obsessive paranoia about control of world events by secret elites. And the real dilemma here, especially with the film JFK being so popular, is sorting out those elements of fact along with those elements that are reasonable to conclude, with those elements that are just really time-honored, ultra-right-wing, you know, conspiracy theories about secret oligarchies and clubs controlling the world. And so if you look back over the last 10 years, you can see that while there have been, in fact, criminal cases and congressional hearings into conspiracies within and around the intelligence communities that were documented, there's also been a real kind of a blooming of conspiracy theories involving those very same intelligence agencies that are really quite fanciful and ultimately distract people from serious criticisms.
One of your theories is that the extreme right is spreading conspiracy theories that are being picked up by the left. And an example that you use, actually, is the film JFK.
Well, unfortunately, yes, that Mr. X, for those who saw the film, was supposedly a person with wide knowledge in the U.S. intelligence community.
This is the Donald Sutherland character.
The Donald Sutherland character, exactly. And Mr. X was, in fact, based on a researcher named Fletcher Prouty, who wrote a book, which was quite a good book some years ago in the 70s, called The Secret Team.
Let me interrupt you for our listeners who haven't seen it. Mr. X is the kind of deep throat character who gives all this secret information to Jim Garrison. And Mr. X is somebody who had worked high up in the military intelligence establishment.
And in fact, Fletcher Prouty is a retired colonel in the United States Air Force who was very high up in the military establishment, and he was one of the coordinators of providing military assistance to the CIA for its covert operations around the world. And so he is quite knowledgeable, and he wrote a quite interesting book in the 70s called The Secret Team. But since then, he's drifted far to the right and is taken up with speaking at events sponsored by people who say the Holocaust is a hoax. And I believe that the dilemma that we're presented with is that people who have these far-right-wing and often anti-Jewish conspiracy theories are piggybacking on the film JFK, people like Prouty, Mark Lane, Victor Marchetti, and a whole range of people on the left who have picked up some of these conspiracy theories are in fact involved in promoting not only the specific views around the JFK assassination, but inevitably bringing in these ideas about, you know, secret oligarchies or Jewish elite banking control of the world into common discussion without being candid or frank about what they represent.
So what's the connection between Oliver Stone and Fletcher Prouty?
Well, Prouty was an advisor to the film. He's listed as an advisor at the end of the film. And of course, the character Mr. X is based primarily on Fletcher Prouty. And Stone praised Prouty's work in a New York Times op-ed piece. And I wrote a letter to Oliver Stone saying that, you know, I liked the film, actually. I thought it was a brilliant piece of filmmaking. But I had a problem with his inadvertent, promotion of people who are connected to these groups that really think that Jews control the world and goes off into these other arcane conspiracy theories that are essentially scapegoating conspiracy theories.
Do you think that Stone was aware of Prouty's connections to these other views?
No, because I've talked to Mr. Prouty and I've read other assertions by some of these people, and they misrepresent the nature of this network of groups that they work with. So I don't think Stone was aware of this, although he was made enough aware of it to distance himself from Prouty during the filming.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chip Berlay. He's an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, and he specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. Another example that you've given of how the extreme right has tried to affect the thinking of the left is the Gulf War.
Yeah, during the Gulf War, there was a kind of a moment when groups on the far right and groups that opposed the war shared an opposition to the war, and that occurred across the political spectrum, and is entirely, you know, legitimate, and anti-war sentiment knows no political allegiance very often. However, what happened was that during the Gulf War crisis, groups which would include the Spotlight Liberty Lobby crowd, the Populist Party, and even the LaRoucheans began to weave their way into anti-war groups, so much so that at one point there was a nationally televised cable program that included a spokesperson for LaRouche making assertions about the Gulf War. And you also saw people like Bo Greitz, who's running on the Populist Party ticket, beginning to talk about left-right coalitions to stop foreign intervention. And groups with as reputable kind of progressive credentials as the Pacifica radio stations began to air some of these people and their convoluted theories about the Gulf War, many of which were really drawn from these arcane conspiracy theories. And again, I think it's perfectly legitimate for these people to have airtime, but I think it's consistent with good radio station policy to let people know that they have some of these connections and that some of these ideas really represent discredited and unprovable assertions.
If you think that people on the extreme right want to either join with or influence the thinking of people on the left, what for?
Well, I can simply look to the writings and speakings of people like Bo Greitz. Greitz has been writing and touring the country on giving radio interviews saying that there is no left and right, that the left and the right have to join together to smash the corrupt government, which is an interesting echo back to the Weimar period in Germany in the 30s and 20s when the same coalition was proposed, and it really didn't have too good an outcome, as many will remember, because when the left and the right joined together in Italy or in Germany, it built the fascist movements in those countries. Now, I hasten to add that this is merely an echo of that syndrome, but historically, the idea that the left and the right should join together and smash the central government has ended up with a far more repressive and brutal government that liquidated its enemies. So I don't think it's a good trade-off. I agree that the government is engaged in wrongdoing and there's tremendous repression, but the solution is not fascism.
What political areas do you think that the extreme right and the left are most likely to come together on?
Well, I'd say primarily government intelligence abuse, both the CIA and domestically the FBI, civil liberties, very often around very, very serious issues that need to be addressed. And in some cases, those coalitions are fine. You know, if you're a civil libertarian, it doesn't matter what your political stripe is. But you also see it around in the environmental movement. Interestingly enough, there in Germany especially, there's been a problem with far-right-wing neo-Nazi groups and in England as well, basically proclaiming themselves to be pro-environmental, because they are, and then bringing in their theories of racial nationalism into environmental groups. Now, to their credit, in Europe, these overtures have been overwhelmingly rejected, whereas in this country, I think there's a little more naivete about what fascism really is.
We're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories with Chip Berlay. He's an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, and he specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Chip Berlay is my guest, and we're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories. Now, another place that you've been finding conspiracy theories catching on is in certain African-American groups, conspiracy theories about the Jews. What kind of theories and in which kind of groups are you talking about?
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of these theories come from the same well, which is essentially the white supremacist movement in the U.S., and they track back many years. And what we see in this country now is, unfortunately, some of the people around Minister Louis Farrakhan adopting some of these theories of Jewish control of the world. And it's gotten to the point where there's a new book out published by the Nation of Islam called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, which makes the assertion ultimately that Jews controlled the slave trade, which is simply not true. And so what you see, I think, is a syndrome where because conditions in urban African-American communities are so terrible and the political police repression is terrible and the systematic exclusion from access to, you know, democracy and the quote-unquote American way of life is real, that you see this scapegoating coming out. And I want to make it very clear that my criticism is of what they're saying about Jews, but I absolutely agree that the conditions that are creating this agony and this anxiety and causing this kind of backlash and scapegoating are also very real. So you have to say both. That, for instance, in the early 80s, when the Farm Belt collapsed, you saw a number of farmers adopting these very same theories of Jewish banking control of the world. And it was because the farm economy had collapsed and these people's backs were against the wall. So you have to, I think it's important to twin that, because we didn't condemn all the farmers out of hand without looking at the social context. And I don't think it's fair to condemn the African American community as a whole for the excesses of a handful of black nationalists.
Gee, what a difficult job you have trying to clarify.
It's a real
political landmine that you're dealing with here, I think.
Yeah, it's a real problem, but it's historically, this is nothing new. I mean, you can look back throughout American history at, for instance, go back to the Salem witch hunts, which was essentially an attempt to reinforce a patriarchal religious order in which women had no power. And so women were scapegoated, essentially, for all that was wrong with the society back then, and they were declared witches and burned. You look at the anti-Catholic scares of the 17 and 1800s, the anti-Masonic theories. Go to the Palmer raids, which are really anti-Italian. The Palmer raids were based on the idea that all Italians were anarchists and all anarchists had bombs, so we had to deport tens of thousands of Italians that were rounded up in December of 1919 and January of 1920. The Red Scare. I mean, this is a periodic moment that occurs throughout American political science, and we're witnessing the current manifestation of these scapegoating conspiracy theories.
Do you think that part of the roots of American conspiracy theory goes back to the John Birch Society and its Blue Book?
Well, not many people know what the Blue Book is, but the Blue Book was the book given to every entering member of the John Birch Society. Of course, you have to understand the Birch Society only came around in the mid-50s and reached its heyday in 1964 with the Goldwater campaign. It's important to differentiate here, because the Birch Society theories officially never embraced racialism or anti-Jewish conspiracy theory. And to their credit, they threw out people who were overtly racist and spun anti-Jewish theories. So the Birch theory is essentially the idea that insiders control the world and that all world governments are run by the same group of power brokers who are secret and operate through front groups like the Trilateralist Commission or the Bilderbergers or there's a number of others. Council on Foreign Relations is one of their bugaboos. So that certainly has had an effect, and a lot of the theories that have come out around JFK and the Gulf War and Iran-Contragate really have their roots in the Birch theories of insider elite control. If you believe in racialism and anti-Jewish conspiracy theory, which is the big dividing line in the American political right, and that would be like the Populist Party, the Spotlight, the Liberty Lobby, and that crowd, then the conspirators are all manipulated by Jews, rich, powerful Jews who are everywhere and, you know, evil. And if you don't believe in racialism and anti-Jewish theories, then you adopt sort of the Birch milieu, which is that it's very powerful banking interests, finance capital that control the world and put the Bolsheviks and Roosevelt in power, you know, essentially.
You've described Pat Buchanan and David Duke as two different strains of historical fascism. What do you mean by that?
Well, people forget that fascism is a relatively new phenomena that was based on the theory of racial nationalism. Not all strains of fascism were Hitlerite. Fascism actually started in Italy, and at the time had actually some support from labor unions and from the left through the idea of national socialism, and the idea that you could have a socialism based on a nation that itself was homogeneic based on either a culture or an ethnicity or a race, something that people shared biologically, essentially, or through some common heritage. And In the United States, the nativist movement of the 1800s, which was very anti-immigrant, sort of evolved into the modern American equivalent of fascist movement throughout the 1930s and 40s and 50s. It simply transmogrified over time. And so there actually is a strain of racial nationalism, which you can detect in reading Buchanan's columns, where he talks about the basis of all loyalty is essentially tribal or racial. And then you can move over to the more extreme wing of fascism, which is the supremacist wing, which believes not only should nations be constituted on a racial basis, which is also the belief, I hasten to add, of Reverend Louis Farrakhan, as well as the white supremacist movement, as well as certain very small factions within the Native American movement, the Warrior Society, which has been criticized by the traditionalist and the American Indian movement because of their racially exclusive view of nation. You can track that across the political spectrum and see that Buchanan represents a kind of heritage of fascism based on racial nationalism, and Duke represents the next step over into the neo-Nazi movement, where you talk essentially about not only racially segregated nations, but ones in which some people are intrinsically superior due to their biology. That's Nazism. That's the difference between fascism, which is racial nationalism, and Nazism, which is biological determinism.
I'm wondering if you ever meet somebody who sounds perfectly rational and you start talking to them about politics and you realize that they're deep into conspiracy theories.
Oh, all the time. I travel by train quite a bit, and it's surprising how many times I'll sit. I like to sit down and strike up conversations with a range of people. And I sat down on an Amtrak train from Chicago to Boston recently and ran into a person who wove this long, elaborate conspiracy theory about, you know, the oil industry controls the banks, which controls the environment. And so if the environmental movement ever wants to get anywhere, it's got to read the works of Eustace Mullins, who writes about the Federal Reserve. Well, I had read some of Mr. Mullins' work, which not only talks about the Federal Reserve, but pretty much encourages the liquidation of Jews on the planet. So it's astonishing how widespread this belief structure is throughout society. And most mainstream journalists never run into it, or if they do, they simply, you know, dismiss it as aberrant. But there's a surprising number of Americans who read The Spotlight, who read LaRouche's publications, and who listen to talk radio and hear these conspiracy theories spun 24 hours a day.
So to what extent are you being cast as a character in the conspiracies now by groups that you've been investigating?
Well, I've long been cast as that character. I have a large clip file of people, you know, discovering that I'm an, you know, assertions like I'm a deep cover FBI agent, or I've worked for the CIA, or my roots are in the Nazi movement, or the LaRouche people once said I was a Latvian spy, or I'm an agent of the grain cartel. I found that one fascinating. I don't know whether I'm supposed to be promoting Wheaties or something, but sure, I'm now part of the conspiracy, and so I've joined the iconography of the conspirators.
Do you ever worry about your safety?
Well, I get death threats from time to time, and I get my picture in some weird newspapers. You know, Tom Metzger once called for me and Lenny Zeskind, another researcher, people to get our pictures so they could publish it. So, you know, I take some precautions. I live in a fairly secluded area. The end of 3-1, you know, dead-end streets, you know. So I try and not take that in a way. I take it seriously, but not in a way that affects my lifestyle that much, you know. So I think it's part of the territory of researching these kinds of groups that are so passionate and so zealous about their beliefs. I've had people stake out my house and sue me and stuff like that. But, you know, here I am calling them neo-Nazis. What do I expect? I sort of have to give them a little room to be angry.
Chip Riley is my guest, and we're talking about extremism and conspiracy theories. I'm wondering if you're following a couple of the conspiracy theories that have been circulating in certain black neighborhoods, and I'm thinking of the theory that goes that AIDS was...
Jewish doctors inject black children with AIDS.
Well, actually, I hadn't heard it that way. I hadn't heard Jews involved in it, but just that it was a kind of government plot to cause genocide among blacks. And the other is similar for drugs. That, you know, drugs have been pushed largely in black neighborhoods to help keep black people down.
Well, I think in both cases, what you have is a classic inversion, which is where you have an objective reality And the way you look at that situation is inverted. In other words, the fact that there are near genocidal conditions in the black community is demonstrable statistically, given infant mortality rates, life expectancy, police brutality, incarceration rates. I think you can defend the idea that we as Americans should be ashamed of that track record, and that it has a devastating effect on the black and African American, and in some cases Hispanic communities. However, to invert that and then say that that's caused by some conscious plan, when in fact I argue it's the result of institutionalized racism, which is accepted by the average American, it's that inversion that I try to struggle against.
When you talk about inversion, do you mean, for instance, that instead of it being a conspiracy to kill the black community, it's more like critical neglect that
Absolutely.
Is responsible for the problem?
Sure. Well, what's responsible for the problem is racism.
And the racism causes the neglect.
Well, right. And it's the inversion which says that there was a conscious plan to do this, when in fact it's much more institutionalized and much more of an organic reality, which we should be ashamed of. But nonetheless, we're not going to solve it by trying to find some secret plan, because, you're never going to find it. What we need to do is change the situation. And that's the ultimate danger of conspiracy theories. I think ultimately the dilemma is that what scapegoating and conspiracy theories allow each of us to do is not take responsibility for what's happening, not take responsibility for racism, not take responsibility for homophobia, not take responsibility for the economic disparities in the country, not take responsibility for the covert action and counterinsurgency policies of the U.S. government. And by simply saying we're not to blame, we can blame a secret team or a secret government or whatever, we're not taking responsibility for citizens for having a elected government officials who have perpetrated these policies in a bipartisan manner for almost 50 years. So I think ultimately it's a mechanism to transfer responsibility off our own shoulders and ultimately pretend that we're not responsible, when we as Americans are responsible.
Well, Chip Roulet, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Chip Roulet is an analyst with the group Political Research Associates, based in Boston. He specializes in researching government intelligence abuses, authoritarianism, and right-wing extremism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.